Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
As we wrap up 2024, the pop culture experts at Consequence are back with our annual report, celebrating the year's best in music and entertainment. And this time, we're bringing you something extra, a brand new podcast series exclusively on Amazon Music. Get inside access with interviews featuring the year's biggest artists, actors, and filmmakers, plus discussions with the Consequence team on our best of the year lists. You can tune in with Amazon Music Unlimited, now free for 3 months. For a limited time, get 3 months of Amazon Music Unlimited free by visiting tryamazonmusic.com/COS. You'll get over 100 million songs in stunning HD sound, on demand and ad-free, plus top ad-free podcasts, including the Consequence Annual Report podcast. Even better, every Amazon Music Unlimited subscriber now gets one free audiobook from Audible each month. So celebrate the best of 2024 with Consequence's Annual Report all December at consequence.net. And don't miss the companion podcast by signing up for 3 free months of Amazon Music Unlimited at tryamazonmusic.com/COS or clicking the link in the show description. That's tryamazonmusic.com/COS. Consequence Podcast Network.
Hi, I'm William from the Jesus and Mary chain, and I'm giving you the story behind the song, Just Like Honey, on Consequence.
Welcome, listeners, to The Story Behind the Song. I'm your host, Peter Chadi of Deep Cuts Media. In this week's episode, I interview William Reed, one half of the great band, the Jesus and Mary chain, one of the most influential bands to come out of the UK in the mid-1980s. William, together with his brother Jim, were punks at their core, choosing to go with distortion-fueled guitars during a time when poppy synths filled the airwaves. William and his brother Jim's story is an unlikely one in many ways, filled with luck, William tells me. That luck led to early shows that caught the eye of label execs, even as they were frequently characterized by crowd mayhem and violence. The result of it all is their 1985 album, Psycho Candy, now considered to be a classic. Jack Black, in the movie High Fidelity, hilariously mocks an unwitting customer in his record store for not knowing it and won't let him leave without buying it. Just Like Honey is the song that kicks off Psycho Candy and is a timeless melody distorted with the Chain's signature fuzz and Phil Spector-inspired wall of sound. It's a timeless classic, and William tells me about it all and about the steps he and his brother took both before and after leading up to their excellent just-released new album, Glasgow Eyes. I found William to be both humble and candid and immensely likable and humorous in his understated way. I enjoyed every minute of my interview. So take a listen as we dive deep into the story behind the Jesus and Mary Chain's classic song, Just Like Honey, with William Reed. William, I always like getting into a little bit of the musical journey. And so you were born in Scotland, and you and your brother, just tell us about a little bit about the scene at the time when you were fairly young lads, and obviously you like music, and just how you two decided to form a band and how you wanted it to be. What influenced you at the time?
Music and society was a lot different in the early 80s. For instance, you would have to find somebody who had that record and would loan it to you. You know, nowadays, if somebody says Sonic Youth, well, the kids can just get their phone and go Sonic Youth. And then every record that Sonic Youth has ever made, oh, now I know what Sonic Youth's like. But in 1982, 83, 84, when we were starting, you had to borrow records, and it was, I think things were way more intense. And I don't know if this is true. This is just anecdotal, but I think people loved music more then than they do now. And if you knew a band was going to be on tube, you stayed in and you watched it. We had a library in the town centre of our town where we grew up, East Kilbride, which was actually a godsend for us because it had a record library as well. And there was a lot of obscure records, and that's how we first discovered Can. Can became a huge influence with us, and you had to seek out, you had to be incredibly enthusiastic to be a music lover.
Well, I think you're exactly right. Because that was my time as well. And as you said, two things about it. When you went to the record stores, you flipped through the albums and you spent hours in the record stores. And that was part of the fun. That was part of the experience. And like you were saying too, with Top of the Pops or whatever music show it was, you couldn't record it, of course. And so you had to be there at that point in time. Otherwise you missed it.
I think when we were starting to get really interested in music was probably, for me, it was when I was about 16, and that would have been 1974. I really wanted to be in a band, and I had a little bass player, and a little bass, and I couldn't play it very well. And then I got a fake Gibson guitar, and I couldn't play that very well either. And it just seemed a bit useless and hopeless and like, what the hell? I'd love to be a musician. I feel like I could write songs. And it didn't seem like anything would ever go anywhere until punk music came along. And when punk happened, it was like, to me and my brother Jim, it was like you were looking through a dirty window and somebody had come along and just cleaned the window. And just suddenly you were like, oh my God, you can be in a band. You don't have to play like Eric Clapton. You don't need a drummer who can play like John Bonham. You know, you could play like the Stooges. You could play like the Velvet Underground. You could play like the Ramones. I know that sounds difficult enough, just of great ideas. But what punk music did to me and my brother was basically just freed us. It just opened the door and says, look, if you can play three chords, you can write a song, you can be in a band. The Ramones can do it, you can do it. And that's what happened. And it took us a long time to really get round to it. We're notoriously slow and lazy. So we kind of messed around, like talking about being in a band for years until about 1982 when my dad got made redundant from his job at a Caterpillar tractor factory. And he gave us his money and we bought a little port studio, a little four-track port studio, which completely, once again, just changed everything because it meant we could not only write songs, but like record them and record four tracks and bounce and blah, blah, blah. And suddenly we're making demos. And that was the next step into like actually doing it. You know, we made a demo, gave it to somebody. Somebody heard it, Alan McGee from Creation Records heard it and took a chance on us with a 7-inch single. That's how we started.
And what was that song?
The first single was Upside Down, but that wasn't on. I don't think that was on the demo tape. In fact, Bobby Gillespie, who like the guy that we had gave our demo tape, didn't like it, but Syd Barrett was on the other side of it. And he knew that Bobby was a Syd Barrett fan, so he said, hey, Bobby, here's the tape with Syd Barrett. Some band gave me it. And Bobby turned over and listened to our demos and phoned up his friend, Alan McGee in London, and said, you should put this band on your showcase night. He had a little showcase thing once a week in London. I'll tell you what's really, really important when starting a band or any endeavour, whether it's a band or a business or a TV show or a movie or whatever, and it's luck. Yeah, so many lucky things happened that we gave a demo tape to somebody who gave Bobby, who gave it to McGee, and who offered us a single. Well, first it wasn't a single. First it was just a show in London. He just said, if you can be here on the 15th of June, then I'll put you on. And we were like, okay. So we all got our pennies together and bought bus tickets to London. And that was the first, that was another big step.
Listen, you know, so many things that you said there that resonate deeply and that I hear over and over again by great musicians such as yourself. The, you know, what you call luck, which I kind of call active serendipity, which is luck happens when you put yourself out there in the world and inject yourself.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
It's like the cliche, like if you don't buy a lottery ticket, you don't buy it, you don't win the lottery. And it's also being brave to like, being open and being brave to like jumping in when opportunities arise. Sometimes opportunities arrive as being fired from your job. You know what I mean? That's happened to me a couple of times where I thought the world is just as a mess and everything's swallowing me up. And you wake up the next day and you realize, oh, this is a different path.
Another thing that struck me, William, about what you said is that I've never heard it that way put, that punk music was washing away the dirt from a dirty window. So it was the clean, the punk music cleansed it for you. So what was it about that? Like, what were you and your brother Jim like? Because I've read that you felt like outsiders.
Well, that's what it was exactly. I mean, we loved music. And I loved the Beatles. I loved the Rolling Stones. And I would listen to their music and how, you know, they were truly great musicians. And I think I'm a punk musician. This is how I say it. When I do a guitar solo, for instance, I'm only looking for three or four notes. You know? I'm not looking to be all over the keyboard. Five different types of scales. I'm from the Joy Division type of solos and hooks, which is, if you can do it with three or four notes, then it sounds like glorious and do it, you know? And, I mean, you know Joy Division, don't you? And you know, like, Ellie Nude Order. And that's my probably my main influence when it comes to guitars. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. That's it. That's beautiful. That's all you need. Eric Clapton, you're great as well, but you don't need to play like you to be sensational or memorable or just genius. That's the way I saw it.
Well, great musicians put their own signature on their sound, and three chords in the truth, the famous rock and roll thing, three chords in the truth, but your sound from the very beginning kind of had this wall of sound to it, the fuzz and the feedback and all that. And so when you listen to the music, including your latest album, there's a richness to it that belies what you were just describing.
The feedback and the sound for the first record was really accidental. It was, once again, it was just one of these just incredibly lucky things that just seemed to fall in place round about the same time, you know. I had an amp, I had a Les Paul copy, I had a little Marshall combo copy, and the sound was just awful, you know. It was just terrible. And I remember me and Jim, like, just, you know, getting really discouraged because we were playing our punk chords and stuff, but it just didn't sound like the Ramones. It didn't sound like the Clash. It was just awful. And then I bought this fuzz pedal for this kid, Queenie, who lived in our street, for about £10, for about £10. And it's called a Shinai, Japanese Shinai pedal. And I plugged it into this cheap amp we've got and plugged it into this cheap guitar and played it. And it went... the huge, huge sound. And then when you stopped playing it, it went, yeah. So I was like, okay, I'll give you £10 for this guy, Queenie. And he actually was going about telling that he had conned me, that he'd sold me a broken fuzz pedal for £10. But it wasn't broken. What it was is it was just difficult to understand. It's not an easy fuzz pedal, but it was glorious. It just changed everything for us. It was like, we've got a guitar sound. It's like, wow, I haven't heard. This is strange. It's just, it's not really a chord. It's more like an intense frequency. But there's a bit of music under there, you know? So we used that. that's what we did. We used it. We bought a couple more of those pedals as well and still use them today.
Isn't that interesting? Because the way you just described it, it's very punk.
Well, I'm not a big reminiscer. I don't like to look back and, you know, what went before. But when we did this book, that's the whole premise of writing a book. And just like this conversation, it made me feel like so many things happened with so much great luck that it, and all within the space of a year, you know, before the band really started, like getting that pedal. And then I got my guitar. Like I told you, I had that 12, that Les Paul Japanese copy, which was really, really terrible. The Japanese are pretty good at making copies, but this was not one of the good ones. But then another stroke of luck happened. A friend was selling his dad's guitar for 20 quid, and he was selling it because it was so old-fashioned. So he brought it down to our house, and it was a Gretsch Country Gentleman. And I didn't know then that there was a, you know, sought-after guitars and amazing guitars and brilliant guitars. So he sold that to me for £20, which probably the real cost of that in 1983 was probably £1,000.
Wow.
Yeah, and he sold it to me for 20, and that just doubly enhanced the sound because I play a lot of times behind the, you know, the bridge, and it makes ding, 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 ding. Well, when you put that through my fuzz pedal, it's crazy. It sounds like it's a big electronic violin playing.
So, William, do you still have that guitar?
I still have that guitar, and I decided when I was on the tube that I didn't like that coffee table look, and I went and got a can of paint, and I painted over my Country Gentleman. And Dave Gilmour from Pink Floyd, he was on that show that day. He was on that show, and I'm on the stage painting. Actually, on the stage painting my guitar black. And the poor guy walked past me and just shaking his head.
Yes, that's funny. That's funny. By the way, David Gilmour's new album is great too.
Oh, I've heard it's fantastic.
Yeah, it's really good. It's really good. But no, that's funny. And I know we have limited time and I want to get into the song, but this is so good to just hear the story there. There's a couple things that I'm not going to ask you to describe it at all, but I have to point it out because everybody's always curious about the name, the Jesus and Mary Chain. And part of the enigma of the band and is that you're tough to pin down. At least, you know, conceptually, people try to put bands in a box and your sound is not, which is a wonderful thing. I think it's a wonderful thing. It's, you don't try to fit it in a box. Similarly, Jesus and Mary Chain is, it's such an impactful name that I'm curious about it. I'm not going to ask you to describe it, but my understanding is that you thought of it though. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was me and it just came out of my head and it didn't mean anything until we started doing interviews and then people would say, what does it mean? And I just get so fed up of saying, well, we needed a name. We wrote a list and we just thought, oh, that one. That became such a boring answer to that question. I would just say, well, I saw it in a Bing Crosby movie.
I heard that one.
And he was talking about Jesus and Mary, oh, Holy Jesus and Mother and Mary Chain, something like that. And I told that for a few times, and then I said I saw it in the back of a cornflake packet, which never made sense. The cornflake packet never made any sense.
But people believed it.
And another one I said I saw it in what novel was it? Some great novel, I forget. I think it may have been, what one? What was the Cervantes novel, the great novel? Don Quixote.
Yeah, Don Quixote.
Yeah, well, that one never stuck. People didn't see me.
Didn't see that.
Nobody believed that one, but the Bing Crosby and the Cornflakes one, where everybody ran with those ones.
Yeah, well that's funny in and of itself. And you mentioned, by the way, like Don Quixote and some great literature and your lyrics. I know that literature is a deeply, at least what I understand it to be, is a deep part of yourselves. And on your new book, as an example, you had some great writers in Europe who are praising the book itself for it being just a fascinating book, a good read and all that sort of thing. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. Some of the ones that I read, like Irvin Welsh from Trainspotting reviewed.
Book. Yeah.
But I do want to ask you, because we're talking about punk and we're talking about how you started and three chords and then the fuzzy sound and all that. Tell us a little bit about the early gigs that you had, the very early gigs when you started out with the band.
Yeah, the gigs could be like amazing and brilliant and also horrible and like catastrophic. Well, because sometimes people, I didn't mind if people came and were rowdy and jumped all over the place, but early on people like started spitting at us. We thought that was like a punk. Did they do that in America? Did punk spit at the bands and stuff?
I didn't see it, but I wasn't in the clubs at that point. But certainly from what I understand, like in New York City, there was, you know, some hardcore punk.
Yeah, well, because we did interviews and spoke about our love for punk and because of our sound, a lot of people would come and spit and, oh my God, it's the most fucking disgusting thing, you know? When like, I remember like, we come off stage once and Jim was like, somebody spat in my mouth.
Oh,
yeah, it was disgusting. We all go, oh God, maybe you'll get meningitis or whatever. Yeah, I remember like when that went away, I was real pleased, you know. I was real pleased when people didn't stretch out and touch my pedals as well. Because when you're playing small clubs, you're not far from the audience.
Yeah.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com. Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
So now, you described the early 80s when you had your early gigs, and then your first full-length album was Psycho Candy, and we're going to be digging into the song Just Like Honey, which starts it out. But when you were writing these first songs for this album, what was your headspace, you and your brother? What were you looking to achieve with this first album? Do you remember just what your state of mind was at that time?
We just felt like we had to be unique. And I think we were confident that we were going to make other albums, but you're never 100% sure, you know? I remember us saying, we can't put four good singles on it and like eight, like, you know? So I think we really strive to make every song as good as the last one. And, you know, maybe that would be our last shot. I don't think we believed it would be our last shot, but we weren't so naive that we didn't know that the music business was a dangerous place. The music industry will see something brilliant about a band or a singer or a songwriter and then want to change them. You know, just, you're so raw, you're so fresh. Here, put on these nice, new, sparkling, clean clothes. And here's a big top producer. And sometimes the rawness and the freshness should not be tampered. And I think we got away with it. Warner's never really bothered us too much sound with the first record. I'm not sure they really understood too much of us. And I think they just wanted to see this first one, we'll see what happens. You know, if it doesn't happen, then they're gone.
Yeah.
If it does, then maybe we'll shape them, you know, into something else. And then the album gets released and the reviews were amazing. And suddenly the record company changed. It was like everybody had a big smile, and we were like, and our manager Al McGee says, I don't think they're going to drop us now.
I think
they're going to keep us on for a while.
And then everybody at the record label who weren't saying anything before, they were saying, I always knew, you know. Then they would say, I always knew it was going to be a well-reviewed album.
People are always like that in the music business.
Yeah, of course. And so let's talk a little bit about Just Like Honey, which opens up the album. And so yeah. I would imagine, since this is your first, I guess your first full length, but also major label album, were you trying to make a statement with that song opening up the album?
Probably. I can't be 100% in that, because you're always second guessing yourself when you're thinking back. You know, you have a little raw information and then there's a lot of guesswork. But I would say we were probably making a statement that, you know us for our noise, but here's this. This is something else that we can do.
Is that, based on what you just said, does the title Just Like Honey, was that a reflection of, well, you expected this, but this is sweeter. It's like honey.
Honey was the very, very last word written in the song. The song was called, I think it was just Like Alice for like a few months. At first it was called In Her Garden. That part, I had written the bulk of the song. And when it came to that part, which is, I guess you could call it the chorus, I couldn't think what to say. I couldn't think what to write. And for a couple of months, I was just singing a song. And we never played it live, but I would play it in the bedroom on my acoustic guitar. And I would just sing, In Her Garden. And it's like, that doesn't sound right. And I was going, In Her Garden. And then I wrote, Just like Alice. And I thought, Just Like Alice, that's nice, Just Like Alice. But it still didn't feel right, you know? And we went to do this John Peel session down in London. Just Like Alice was one of the songs we were going to do. But me and Jim were just, it just didn't sound right. It was just, that just sounds clumsy. It just sounds clumsy. And we'll go, well, we're going to record it in an hour and a half. We need to come up with something. And we sat for about 20 minutes before Jim did the vocal. And I said, well, we mentioned honey in the, you know, one of the other verses. Why don't we just make Just Like Honey? And he goes, okay, that's that. And I go, okay, right, Just Like Honey, right, that's that. He goes, right. And then he went into the recording booth and that was it.
See, there's another example of just, you know, something comes to you at the time and you run with it.
It made perfect sense, but I couldn't see that for months. I just couldn't see it. I had just like, oh, what is it? Just like something. You know, it never happened until the last minute, which, I'll be honest, that's happened to me 1,000 times in this band.
Yeah.
You've got almost nothing until the last minute, bam, then you've got it.
Would you say that you have a typical process with you and your brother, how you write your songs? So, you know, starting from that song, if you can, do you recall when the melody first came to your head, and then the lyrics, it sounded like followed that a little bit. But do you remember that?
I do. I remember writing the bulk of the song in my bedroom that I shared with Jim in East Kilbride, where we live, just outside Glasgow. And I remember thinking it was a really good song. And sometimes when I write, you know, songs that I think are my best, I'm always suspicious that I've, you know, picked up something. I've picked up somebody else's song. And I remember going around asking my friends and Jim and Bobby and Douglas, like, what is this? And I was like, listen to the girl. And they said, no, it's good. I said, yeah, but who did it originally? And they're going, I don't think anybody. And I'm going, no, you sure? Sounds too good. When you're an artist, you're two things. You're full of ego and you're full of yourself. And you're also completely unsure of yourself as well. You know, you're also like you're this close to success and this close to failure always.
That's fascinating.
So anyway, the song turned out not to be somebody else's, thank God. So it was just like Alice for a couple of months until it wasn't.
But did you know that you had something there that was special?
Yeah, that's why I was asking people who wrote this song originally. Uh-huh. And nobody could figure it. I do that all the time. It's like when I wrote April Skies, I originally wrote that while imitating Elvis Presley as a joke for my then girlfriend. I was being in the kitchen and she was walking around and I was just going, hey, honey, what you trying to say? And she says, what is that? And I says, no, I'm messing around. She said, get your tape recorder and record that. That's good. And a lot of time you don't know. And I'm like, well, I'm just impersonating Elvis. She goes, yeah, but it's good.
That's funny. So your process, it sounds like, is not really a process. Something comes to you.
Yeah. I mean, if you sit down and say, I'm going to write a song, you probably won't write a song. But if you sit down and say, I'm going to watch TV while messing around on my guitar and play some chords, there's a good chance you might write a song. You know, it'll come to you. You'll hit two chords and it strikes you. You know, something strikes you. They sound nice. And 10 minutes later, you're saying something. That's how it works with me. It's not really planned. It just happens, you know, thankfully.
Just quickly, Psycho Candy, how did you think of that as the album, the name of your first full-length album?
It kind of describes the music pretty well. It's a good name, but the one we had before it, because we thought, you know, that we should get noticed. And if our music doesn't get noticed, then maybe we should call the album something controversial. And I remember for a few days, the album was going to get called Cunt. And it seemed like a good idea. But luckily we come up with Psycho Candy. Well, I know in 1985, nobody would have released a record called Cunt.
Yeah.
They just wouldn't.
I
think the music was good enough that we didn't really need to give it a controversial name.
Yeah. Psycho Candy is a great name. And by the way, that word, of course, in the UK is used very differently than it is in the US as well.
In the UK, it's used almost as an affirmative to a friendship. Yeah. Like, you know, you're a good cunt, you. You're one of the best cunts I've known. In fact, once when I came, this was about 1994, and I had an American girlfriend, and we were out with her girlfriend. We went for dinner, and her girlfriend and her boyfriend. And I said to Richie, that was the guy's name, I said to him, he was a cheeky cunt or something. But anyway, when we get back home after dinner, like my girlfriend says, so why don't you like Richie? And I was like, Richie's a cool guy. I never said I didn't like him. You called him a cunt. I said, I never called him a cunt. I said he was a cheeky cunt. He said, well, Richie thinks you called him a cunt. And I had to go on the phone to Richie and I had to explain. There's a thing in Scotland where we call you a cunt, but it's endearing. Poor guy believed me eventually, but he just said, well, I thought maybe I'd upset you. And I was like, no.
Yeah. That's funny. That's funny. Just like honey.
Just like honey.
Big year. You know, as I said, it's almost 40 years since Psycho Candy, but it's 40 years from your first album, and you have your new album, Glasgow Eyes, that I have been listening to over and over again. And what strikes me, you know, something maybe from the era where you got started, which is great music, but it sounds very much just of that era. Whereas I think Jesus and Mary Jane it's interesting how it sounds fresh. Like if you listen to Just Like Honey, it sounds like that's a song that could be just as, coming born today, which is interesting. And so when you listen to Glasgow mm-hmm. Eyes, and I told you about American Born and being just one really great song, tell me a little bit about that album, of how long that took to pull together and what you were seeking to do with that album.
The album started disastrously. We started it in, I think, October 2019, and we were getting on great. Then COVID happened. Mm. That was us for another year, so there was nothing being done. And we went back in the studio in 2021. This was a studio in Scotland. And we recorded about 8 songs. And this was maybe up until October 22. And we were going back in the studio in Dunfermline, Scotland in 2022. And the engineer informed us that he couldn't find the songs we'd recorded. And we said, "You've lost the songs." "No, I haven't lost them. I just can't find them." And so this went on. Yeah, this went on for days and days. But eventually what happened was he couldn't find them. We lost half of the album we recorded. That's never happened to us before.
Wait a second. He never found them?
He never made backups. He lost the originals and he never made backups.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty awful. But that's like a dagger to the heart, because you know, you've done so much work, and it's things that can't be gotten back. You know, a little bit of guitar bit you did that you thought was quite nice, and now it's gone forever. So that was quite disheartening. And Jim, credit to Jim, you know, Jim went in a recording studio next to him where he lives, and he just recorded 3 or 4 of his songs that got lost straight away. But I was kind of shattered, to be honest. It really hurt me. It really affected me, and it kind of made me, for a while just want to give up. I felt like it was like a real kick in the face. But eventually I came back together and we started afresh in Glasgow, Scotland. Do you know the band Mogwai?
Yeah, I know the band Mogwai.
Stuart Braithwaite, who's in Mogwai, we told him about this and we were really depressed and stuff. And he said, "Well, look, come and record. Come to Glasgow and record in our studio, and we'll give you a good deal and we'll make sure that we're back up." So we did that. We went back to Scotland for the summer of, oh my God, where was it? Summer of 2023, and we got it done. And it was pretty good, and then mixed it in the autumn.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I can't even imagine. That's an amazing story that happens kind of in this era, because I would think that everything is just backed up so much. And so,
well, I've told every engineer I've told us to, they can't believe it. They're like, "Did he back it up? Is it on the cloud?" And I was like, "I don't know. He said nothing's on the cloud, but he said he did back up, but he can't find the backup."
Wow.
To this day, this guy hasn't apologized, not probably. Ooh. He won't say the words "lost." He will say, "Not lost, I can't find them." And it's like, oh, for fuck's sake. You know, if you can't find them, they're lost.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, look, I can't even imagine with all that work. And like you said, music is so ephemeral. Nothing is ever played the same if you're a human being.
Right. Yeah, nothing. But like I said to you, there's certain things, like a guitar sound or what, any sound, it's manipulated in the studio, and sometimes that's all you get. You know, you get this guitar sound and you get back to the same guitar, the same amp a year later, and you still can't get that guitar sound. You know, something's different and you just can't get it. And that's why I was really depressed, because a couple of the songs that got wiped of mine were like, oh, just songs I loved, you know, and I thought were like so cool. But, you know, we went back and we, what's that Chumbawamba song?
Oh,
I get knocked down,
but I get up again.
That's what we did. It felt like we were defeated by the universe, but we went back in there, We worked with a guy called Tony Dugan, who works with Snow Patrol and Mogwai and a bunch of others, and he was fantastic. He helped us, you know, a hell of a lot.
Yeah. I mean, look, the reviews have been excellent on the album, and I really do urge people to go and check out Glasgow Eyes. It is a vintage, like classic, great The Jesus and Mary Chain album. And so I really urge you to check it out. And then also on tour with the Psychedelic Furs, also new book, Never Understood, The Jesus and Mary Chain. And Never Understood is the name of one of a Jesus and Mary Chain song, Mary Chain song. So, and then just one last thing I want to ask you, William, what music today is on your playlist? What are you listening to from an artist that you find interesting right now of any era, but what is striking you right now?
Anything that strikes me is welcome, you know. I think the older I get, the harder it is to see anything really original. I think me and Jim were talking about this the other week there, actually. We were saying, like, one of the troubles or problems with getting old is when you hear music, you see the references or roots from where it comes from. You know, you hear a band, you go, oh, they're pretty good. That bit's Joy Division, that bit's the Bunnymen, this bit's, you know. And I don't really like feeling like that, but I guess it's always been like that. And I'm guessing, like, when Van Morrison saw us in a hotel in 1987, maybe what he was saying is, oh, that bit's me, and that bit's Lou Reed, and that bit's David Bowie. You know what I mean? When we saw him way back then, the time he saw us and rolled his eyes at us.
One band that I think is really kind of almost like a throwback in a sense, because it's just great guitars, Fontaine's BC, I think it's a great band.
Oh my God. My wife loves Fontaine's. She's Irish as well. Yeah. And oh, she thinks they're geniuses. And we played a couple of festivals with them, actually. I've watched them since then. They're a great band.
Yeah.
I take my wife's word for it more than anything. She tells me how great they are.
That was William Reid, one half of the great influential UK band The Jesus and Mary Chain, telling the story behind Just Like Honey from the band's classic 1985 album, Psycho Candy. I'm your host, Peter Chatti of Deep Cuts Media. Stay tuned each Monday for another episode of new interviews mixed with encore episodes of some of my favorites with the greatest artists of the past several decades. Reach out to me at peter@deepcutsmedia.com if you want to add your own icons to the list. And make sure to like, subscribe, and share each episode and the show itself. Until next week, you can revisit all of my 40-plus interviews from seasons 1 and 2. The artists are legendary, their stories are classic and timeless. And as always, thanks for listening to The Story Behind the Song.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.